women 60 plus are absolutely online. It's, we joke now that our first DM that we got a couple of days after we launched on Facebook was from an 89-year-old woman.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof.
If there's anything I've noticed from our work on this show, it's that sometimes we focus on the bright, shiny object instead of the quote-unquote unsexy technologies and products we as humans need to survive. Case in point, ventilators. We talk about virtual reality far more than we talk about ventilators, but turns out the latter was far more important than the former to surviving 2020. Another unsexy topic is the fact that we all have something in common. We're all aging, every single one of us, and we don't talk enough about meeting the needs of consumers as they age. Mia Abruzzese and Alexandra Fennell launched Attention Grace, the first cleaner, greener personal care brand for women 40 plus, starting with a $2.5 billion bladder leakage market. They're on a mission to destigmatize aging, and I wanted to have them on to discuss how they're trying to launch a product in such a challenging year. But let's jump right into the conversation. Mia, Alex, welcome to Future Proof.
Hi, Jeremy.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
So I wanted to ask you both who you are and what you do on a day-to-day basis.
So Attention Grace is really looking at women's health and wellness from an entirely different perspective, from a more modern, a more curated perspective. And Alex and I started it, well, we started working on it 2+ years ago after an experience that I had with my mother, but really only launched 3 months ago, about 3 months ago. And it was a long road to raising money, getting people interested in this demographic that people call age tech or silver tech, or there's lots of names for it right now. But this demographic is finally being realized and finally being spoken to. I'm 54 and I experience not all the issues, but a lot of the issues women experience when they age. And as I sit and talk to our customers, there's a litany of things that we've been learning, and we're using them as a part of our product roadmap as we go and develop more products for women and all the issues that we all face as we age that we basically don't talk about. And so part of it is getting women to open up about and building that community around women's health and aging. But in terms of dividing roles and things like that, as Alex and I as co-founders, we're married, so we're here in the same room, and COVID has helped us launch this business in the sense that we've been able to work together, so it hasn't been so divisive for us. But I do more of the operational side of the business. I owned a footwear and apparel company for 16 years, and I sold it probably a little over a year ago to another apparel company. And really, my background was brand building, but more on the operational sales side of things. And Alex has come on and handled really marketing.
Kind of everything
and,
else, yeah. So my background is I was a lawyer for probably a little too long, about 15 or 16 years. And I'm really working on building the brand, the content, the community, building out our team. I think when you're starting a company out of the gate, it's all hands on deck for all things. So it's every day is a little bit different right now, which is really fun. But really spending a lot of time getting to know our consumers and what's working for them, what's not working for them, really listening to what they're saying and trying to, you know, continue to build from there.
So I think one thing that's interesting I want to ask you in terms of how you identified this opportunity. And Mia, why did you think it was so important that the market have a sustainable wellness brand for women as they age? And I say this as somebody where you're preaching to the choir because you're talking about 50% of the population and then a long percentage of their, you know, lifespan. So it seems to me like it makes a lot of sense. But how did you identify that opportunity specifically?
It came about from a personal experience I had with my mom. So I was home one afternoon. My mom was 89 at the time. She lived alone in the same house we grew up in. She was a curated, Saks shopping, Whole Foods shopping, still driving woman. She was getting her nails done every week and her hair blown out every 2 weeks. And she just really lived a very beautiful, curated life. And here she was this afternoon, stuffing some Depends that she was wearing into the plastic sleeve the newspaper got delivered in. And when I saw that, it was really jarring to see that kind of a degrading experience that she was having. And for someone that was living such a nice life in every other aspect. But I got home. So I got home and I was telling Alex about it. And Alex was there unpacking the Honest Company box. And so the diapers and the wipes and the cleaning products that we got that are curated and free of and gets delivered to your door on our schedule. I thought, why isn't there a solution like this for someone like my mom and women as they age? And so we started with incontinence. And then, but what we started to realize as we were working with people on brand strategy and thinking about how we wanted this brand to be built, it was started to become more about, less about products and more about the environment we wanted to create for women. And we knew we couldn't create a brand these days that didn't have sustainability as one of its pillars. And so early on, I was talking to Alex, and I said, this is much like what they did in the femtech space with period products. But the difference in organic tampons and things like that, but the difference was that with period products, you're wearing those maybe 5 days a month, maybe a liner and then a tampon. But with these incontinence products, women are wearing them every single day and they're wearing multiple products a day. And I think it's what one in three women experiences some level of incontinence. And here in the US, it's 25 million women and it's supposed to grow at a rate of about 8 to 10% a year. So it's a huge market. And because these women are wearing it every day, as you age, your skin gets thinner, this issue of incontinence becomes more and more prominent. And so having products that are free of one of the more finer points in our product is the top sheet is made from sugarcane waste. So it's a biodegradable, renewable resource, as opposed to all the leading brands, which use petroleum. So that's one of the key differentiators. Or
petroleum-based synthetic.
And so the beautiful thing there is one of the comments that we get from most of the people that we talk to is that it's completely eliminated any irritations they've had. And so not only is the irritation, limiting the irritation good, but it's also caused them to use less products because that irritation causes you to think you need to go to the bathroom more often. So it's cleared up a lot of issues for people. And we're really thrilled with that opportunity to introduce products that are free of a lot of these chemicals and that are a little bit more sustainable in the sense that they use less super absorbent polymer and they're much thinner than a lot of the products on the market.
Yeah. And I think too, Jeremy, we've become accustomed. So Mia said she's 54, I'm 44. And sustainability was just given to us when we were building. It would seem, I don't know, unheard of to me to start a new brand in this moment in time and not have sustainability being one of your pillars. But in addition to that, we're used to shopping in our 30s or 40s, even younger than that. We're used to having greener, cleaner options in almost every other way that we care for ourselves. I'm personally used to shopping beauty counter and we're using more eco-friendly products for our children all the time and all of that. But as we dug into this demographic and as we spoke to more and more women, it was pretty quickly apparent that there hasn't been that same shift in terms of cleaner sourcing and better for you ingredients and that sort of thing for products geared towards this older demographic. So that became a big part of what we wanted to change here. We have this phrase we say a lot, like when you're younger, as a woman in particular, you're used to brands wooing you every step of the way. They try to align with your personal and larger values, in addition to supplying you with really great products. And then all of a sudden you hit a certain point in your life and you're nobody's brand darling anymore. No one's really talking to you the way that they used to. And we want to change that.
Well, and I think you're touching on, by the way, two different things at the same time, which are really interesting. One thing to me is that there's this thing that we have not, as a society, dealt with, which is just the fact that we all age and we all, like, there are things that accompany that. And we all go to the bathroom. We women breastfeed. Like, these are things that I think that we all have different levels of comfort with. And I'm wondering, where does the U.S. sit with that? Are we a little better than some countries? Are we a little bit worse? And is there any data to back that up? Because I'm hoping that we're moving in a direction where we're a little bit more accepting of things that you have to accept because they're going to be here no matter what.
They're just part of life. I think there are some countries that do this, particularly with respect to our demographic and aging, the aging population, the notion of aging in general, it's an oftentimes an East versus West kind of comparison that we find ourselves drawing. In the Eastern part of the world, elders are revered and celebrated, and aging is really just, it's celebrated and respected. And whereas in our culture here and many others around the world, it's almost something that people fear and dread and want to push away. It's anti-aging this, anti-aging that, reverse the wrinkles, reverse all the things that would show that you've lived a long, full life. And so I think we'd probably do it better than some, but a lot worse than, for instance, the Eastern countries would do.
Well, and I think it became, you don't find senior living facilities in Asia. So I spent a lot of time in Asia, and you don't find senior living facilities in Asia. Your parents live with you. They help you take care of the children. They're part of the fabric of this sort of larger extended family. In the U.S., now we have these senior living facilities. We have nursing homes and things like that. And with the onset of what happened with COVID and how these nursing homes, you know, protected or didn't protect our parents and grandparents, I think we're going to find lots of new businesses develop around helping families age in place and helping build that closer knit environment, I think. So I think COVID's going to, there are going to be a lot of new businesses that are going to pop up relative to aging and how our elders age here in the U.S. society.
Yeah, I just actually read a statistic this morning that said something like 40% of retirees in the States right now are just completely taking a different look at what their plan had been in terms of whether they were going to head to a 55 plus community or they were going to stay in their homes. And it's interesting. It seems to be going in both directions. There are some people who feel like they need more support now and need to go into a community where they had planned to stay home, but also many people saying precisely the opposite.
It's interesting. I was actually thinking, oh, it's great that we're moving towards this progressive future of taking care of people who have a lot of utility and have been part of our family that we're coming from. But then it actually strikes me as, no, that's actually going back to the way things were at a certain point. Yeah, hopefully, obviously, we'll see more of that. But I think another thing that to me is really interesting is that, like you said, you have women who are not just being marketed to, but they're often the visual within a lot of advertising. And as somebody who worked in beauty for a lot of years, I apologize for that. But it's interesting how, like you said, there's this demographic that is not catered to. And I'm wondering why, dear God, why, when we have such a capitalistic society that in theory should have been able to address this if there was money to be made? Because just to be from a cynical standpoint, if you show people that there's some money to be made in an area and if it's being underserved, then generally speaking, you wouldn't assume that gap would be there for that long.
Yeah, I think part of it, and this is certainly something that we experienced all the time when we were out doing our early fundraising, which, as Mia said, was we started working on this a couple of years ago. So the dynamic has shifted in, I think, a very positive way in the last, really in the last like 12 to 18 months, I would say. But when we started out, I think there was so much hesitation, or not hesitation, but skepticism around the ability to engage with older consumers digitally. And the digital playbook has become what investors are comfortable with, particularly in the CPG space. It's become what entrepreneurs are familiar with and comfortable with. And so I think if you're operating under the assumption that you can't connect with, for instance, the woman that we're building Attention Grace for via Facebook or texting or fill in the blank, I can understand having that trepidation to jump into this market, but we knew just from our like early, very ad hoc kind of research that we were doing that women 60 plus are absolutely online. We joke now that our first DM that we got a couple of days after we launched on Facebook was from an 89-year-old woman, lived by herself, not hanging out with her kids, and women are reachable, as are men who are older. They're very digitally savvy, and that is only going to increase as we all start to age into different issues. So I think that's a big part of the reason this has been such a slow area to develop. But I think we're going to start seeing big changes.
One of the things I was going to say was we're actually finding out how similar things are as opposed to how different they are in some ways. They're using their mobile phones to order. So when we look at the, I don't love to order on my mobile phone, but they, like 40% of our customers are ordering on mobile. And so the way they're actually more similar than we think. They do DM us. They do use the chatbot on the website. So they're using all the technology that they're not doing TikTok videos necessarily. They're using all the technology the same way that millennials and younger people are using. They are doing TikTok videos, I think, with their grandkids.
No, I was going to say.
COVID got it up.
Those will do particularly well, if anything. Yeah. But I think it raises a really important point, which is sometimes people do make assumptions about a particular demographic, which then, you know, when you actually get in the weeds, you find out, nope, they're not actually necessarily true. Or do you see any differences in terms of, I know you might not be like, let's say, e-commerce lifers in the same way that I've been, but you obviously have some experience with that type of technology. So have you notice any differences in what an older consumer might expect from an e-commerce experience?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest differences is this fear of subscription. So that idea that someone is tied to something and that they can't cancel or they can't pause or they can't. So oftentimes what we'll get is, you're sure I can cancel? I can cancel anytime. And so there's that fear. I think that's the biggest one. But one of the things that we, I think that's probably the biggest fear that we've had is, and they do like to use the phone. So I will talk to more people on the phone. So I know about Trudy's incontinence issues. And I also know about her family. She lives with her daughter and how many grandchildren she has. And I actually know how many. It's just amazing. Yeah.
I think it goes back to being a trust issue overall for a couple of things. So certainly within the subscription space and the e-commerce space generally, like there's a little bit more hesitation, I think, than with the people like us who've grown up a little bit subscribing to various different products. But it also, this is a super high trust space generally. So it's compounded in the sense that women may not love the products that they're using, but they've used them and like they know they're working enough for their current purposes. And so there's a bit of a hurdle you have to get over in terms of convincing them to try something new in this space, layer on top of that you're a D2C brand, e-commerce and subscription based. So there's a bit of education and trust.
Well, and the idea of the free sample, that's always been one. So the free sample with the free shipping. And so is it really free? And what's the catch? And
yeah.
Can I cancel it?
So there's. But the kind of cool thing about it is, and this is going to get more difficult, obviously, as we scale, but we're getting to know our customers really well through these different conversations that we're having, especially when it's by phone. I feel like we're unlocking insights that certainly would get lost in a chat, would definitely get lost in a standard automated process. I think that's been actually a positive. Yeah.
I was going to say I don't know if you have seen positive specifically about having a plan to launch a D2C brand and then having 2020 hit and then throw a lot of plans that people had, just they immediately realized they had to pivot. Were there any benefits to going through that type of craziness? It's fine if not. And what was it like in trying to figure out how do we launch in a certain way in a, you know, meaningful way at a time like this?
Yeah, it was a remarkable experience. We were supposed to launch in March. So this obviously COVID hit right around then. We had just gone into quarantine. And because of the products we're making, they're heavily reliant on the same components that go into PPE. So our factories were delayed just because the raw materials weren't available. And then on top of it, our factories are in Europe, and a couple of them were like right in the hot spots early on. So we definitely had delays, but fortunately, we were able to get our product in early, like most of it in early June, and then the rest of it in August. So relative to some of the other stories I've heard, we really can't complain. We haven't had to pivot our model at all. If anything, because people are shopping more and more online as a result of COVID, that's probably only been a positive. for us in the business sense of things. And I also think the lag time for us, that period from like March to June, as difficult as it was for everyone everywhere, it forced us to, it gave us an opportunity to, I think, be a little bit more introspective about the launch and how do you launch a brand at a moment in time like this. I remember having a lot of conversations in May thinking like, how do you possibly come out all, woohoo, I'm launching a new consumer brand when we're in the middle of this crisis. And then layered on top of all of that, all of the protests and everything that were starting to happen around the Black Lives Matter movement. And so we launched at a sort of very unique moment in time. And we tried our best to be aware of all of that and not be tone deaf. But it was definitely an unusual time frame within Duolingo.
And I think it helped that we had just closed our round in May. March. And so it allowed us the runway to weather through it. And then once we did launch, we had a lot of outreach in terms of additional investment. So it's been really interesting to see the interest in the space. And I think that's also helped us slowly anticipate, our needs in terms of staffing and things like that too.
So I have to ask, because I know we were just talking a little bit about investment. It seems that a lot of large consumer brand multinationals and also VCs are missing out by not focusing on our older population. We went over that, but do VCs miss out by not investing in many female founders? Is that something that you've seen? Anecdotally, I've seen and heard a little bit on that front.
Yeah. I think they certainly do. Alex has a few statistics that they've done in terms of the amount of revenue generated by female founders versus the amount of revenue generated by male founders.
Yeah, I think so. Yes, absolutely. There's no question that funds are missing out by not investing in more female founders. And there is more than anecdotal data to back that up. I think one of my favorite pieces of data is from a survey that First Round Capital did that found that the female founded companies that it had funded performed 63% better than the all-male founding teams that it had funded. And then the other one is from Ewing, Mary, and Kauffman Foundation, where they did a study that found women-led teams generate 35% higher ROI than all-male teams. And I could go on and on. There's tons of statistics out there to support this. And it blows my mind. I don't understand why in this day and age this is even a conversation.
Because I don't think investors see themselves. So you need to see yourself. Sometimes you need to see the opportunity. I always do like the story of the Outdoor Voices founder. When she was out raising money, all the investors would go home and say, I'll go ask my wife about this sort of product line. And so I think that's part of the problem is unless they understand the problem and the issue and can see it from their point of view and can see it in front of them, it's really hard for them to understand. Now, I think a lot of that's changing. I think there's probably still an amount of, I still have to go ask my wife if this is actually a thing.
Particularly in our space.
Yeah.
But at least here, the nice thing is obviously pitching something with somebody that you're married to. You understand the dynamics, if you will, of that other side. But they shouldn't have to, if there's a market opportunity, ask their wife. If there's a market opportunity, that's what should matter.
And I think there's always been huge market opportunities around women's health. And I don't have those statistics at the ready, but I'm familiar enough with them to say it's not ever received the same amount of funding and attention as men's health issues, let alone something as stigmatized and unsexy as bladder leakage or any of the other fun things that happen to our bodies post-menopause and post-childbirth and all of those things. So I think it's not just, there's some sort of reluctance there, not like where the market opportunity just like isn't enough. Maybe it's not exciting enough or sexy enough. I don't know.
Is it a little bit more difficult, essentially going out, trying to raise money or something like that, happening to be co-founders who are female and are married? Is that something?
And have four kids. And have four kids, yeah. It's funny. I don't know that we know, right? There were one or two occasions out of over 100 meetings that we've had over time where it was clearly an issue, but in the vast majority of cases, it never presented as an obstacle. That doesn't mean to say that it wasn't, and it just wasn't being called out. But it's the way we would always explain it, frankly, was we, for better or worse, live and breathe this business. We talk about it all the time. We're able to, there's a synergy that's in our everyday of running this company that I think does stem from the fact that we're married, and particularly now in COVID, we're actually able to be physically present with one another. But
well, and the risk, right? So we took this huge risk, both financially and, you know, emotionally. And I sold a company, and Alex left a big job as a partner at a significant law firm to go and do this. So I think taking that risk speaks volumes to how far we want to go with this and the kind of belief that we have in it.
And that actually, you're right, was a positive. I remember now a couple of times that came up in meetings, incidentally, with female angel investors, but who would say, wow, you've really got to believe in what you're doing because you've literally put all of your cards in one deck. So
as my brother-in-law would say to me, who's a VC and who was our first investor, you don't have to do this, right?
I started my agency, and I think that first week of us being in business is when I found out I was expecting, or my wife was expecting, our first child. Talk about timing, I totally get it. But actually, as an aside, I just want to leave you guys with this. I'm out of curiosity. I'm hardly getting through COVID-19 and working from home, and not to mention being out of my nice studio with three little kids and three animals at home. So how are you faring doing all of this with four?
Yeah.
It's been absolutely insane at times, particularly in the beginning. March, April, and May were really tough. But I think, and there are days when it's just incredibly stressful. I think we really we do our best to keep a sense of humor about it. Fortunately, to our two youngest, they're 21 months and twins, and they're easy babies. Yeah. So that helps.
Well, and now the boys are finally back in school, and so that's like helping. The Zoom schooling that made things really difficult.
Yeah, our kids were too young really to do it, to manage it. And so they're back in person right now for at least the next few weeks. So that's been a big help.
And we don't do it without help. So our babies have a nanny, and so that makes things easier.
Yeah, definitely. I think, as I say, my kids are 7, 4, and 1. So if I could predict the future, and if I knew there was going to be a pandemic, I probably would have had them 7 years earlier. Be a lot easier right now. But right. Mia, Alex, I think it's really obviously inspirational to hear what you guys have been able to get out the gate in a very trying year. And I'm excited to follow what's to come. So thanks so much.
Thank you for having us, Jeremy.
Thanks again to Alex and Mia for making the time. I truly do believe that we're going to have to think long and hard about how do we address consumers as they age, since, frankly, our population is going to be an aging population if you look at all of the trend lines. So, food for thought. If you like what you just heard and this is your first time here, be sure to subscribe. Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Stitcher, the choice is yours. And if you're a longtime listener, please remember to rate and review Future Proof, as that's the number one way we get this show in front of people just like you. Special thanks this week to associate producers Jason Stack and V. Cortuccio, and assistant producers Aaron Cohen and Michelle Portnoy. Once again, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.